English singer-songwriter and guitarist Richard Thompson is the ultimate musician's musician. He was still a teenager when he co-founded the folk rock band Fairport Convention in the 1960s. For over 50 years, his songs and guitar work, mostly as a solo artist, have influenced generations of musicians and have earned him Grammy nominations, an Ivor Novello Award, even an OBE. And he joins me now ahead of his appearance at the Kilkenny Arts Festival and a short tour around Ireland. Just wondering what the teenage Richard Thompson thought back in those, you know, mid-1960s. Had he any inkling that the almost 70-year-old Richard Thompson would be talking about an Irish tour 50 years hence?
Well, you know, when you're 19, 20 years old, you're not thinking about the future. Well, we were barely thinking, you know, 3-6 months ahead. We were just having a really good time playing music. And we thought, well, this can't last forever. You know, at some point we have to go back to, you know, university or something, have to get real jobs, we have to become accountants and bankers or whatever life thrusts at us. But, you know, I've been slightly looking over my shoulder ever since in disbelief that this is a living, that I can actually keep doing this.
Was there even an ambition at that point? Maybe not for a half a century of life as a musician, but, you know, was there a point even further on when ambition became or even a knowledge stunk in, yeah, this is my life and this is what my life is going to be?
Well, I figured I could probably survive as a musician somehow. You know, maybe I could be a session guitarist or I could be a songwriter for other people. I didn't really think, you know, as a performer, that was a future. But I suppose, gosh, when it goes about 30s, probably mid-30s, I thought, okay, I think I'm onto something here. And it took my parents another, like, 20 years to get used to the idea that I was actually earning a living as a musician. You know, they kept asking me when I was going to settle down and get a real job. This is until I was about 50. Come on, folks, really? Yeah, that long.
I mean, the Fairport Convention days, when that started out, England was and British music was in a very particular place, particularly folk music. How would you describe the kind of energy that was around in the mid-60s in Britain?
Well, the mid-60s, in folk terms, it was a very healthy folk club scene. I mean, there may have been, you know, estimates vary. There may have been like 600 folk clubs in Great Britain, you know. But it was quite an isolated scene. That wasn't something that really crossed over or came anywhere near to popular music or to rock music. It was just this world on its own. But it had extraordinary people in it. You had, you know, your Davy Grahams, Martin Carthy, Shirley Collins. You know, these extraordinary people. You had Burt Lloyd and Ewan McColl kind of making the rules about how traditional music should be sung, or that kind of thing. You had clubs where you weren't allowed to bring in an instrument, an accompanying instrument. You had to sing unaccompanied. There's all kinds of wacky stuff. But it was extraordinary, and it was very thriving in its own way. But I think what happened with Fairport, when Fairport started to play that music electric, it brought it closer to the mainstream. And I think that was really one aspect of our intention, anyway, was to not have traditional music as this isolated, scholarly thing that lived in museums and libraries. It was something alive. You could still sing these great old ballads, and they would still reverberate for people today.
And was there any kind of, had Dylan already broken the electric barrier for you in some ways, or was there a turned up nose to Fairport when the electric sound was there?
Well, you know, Dylan had done it a couple of years earlier. Mm. You know, he went electric at the Newport Folk Festival and you know, bloodied a few noses in the process. When Fairport started electrifying the British music, not everyone was happy about that. Traditionalists, you know, really thought this was sacrilege. But I've always taken a looser view of music. And I always think that something, you know, it's not precious. I don't see it as precious. I see it as something that you work with and you use. And in every generation, there will be a different kind of a revival of that music.
What did electric bring, though, do you think? Because it brought something to the table. It might be hard enough to define, but you were there when it really came to the fore. What, for you, did it bring that acoustic couldn't provide?
Well, I think it brought energy. And, you know, we were singing these old ballads like Matty Groves, you know, that are incredibly vivid and graphic. And couple that with the energy and the loudness of rock music. You know, you add bass drums to that stuff, and it's really extraordinarily powerful. So it was a kind of a nice marriage in many ways. And I think we were just looking for some way to validate what we did. We didn't want to be imitators of American music anymore. So we were looking to our own roots. And this seemed to be the perfect way of kind of validating ourselves and giving something for the audience that they would perhaps recognise and take to their hearts.
You really place, I think, I've heard you speak about this, and I guess your 1,000 years of popular music kind of puts this in show form as well. Those ballads are the foundation stone of much of popular music right through to the 21st century.
Yes, I suppose that is actually true. And I think it goes in cycles. I think sometimes people really want to reconnect with their roots, and sometimes they want to be more exploratory, if you like, in terms of music. But it seems to cycle around every 10, 20 years. You get this desire to get a little bit closer to those traditions. But as you say, it really is... the basis for everything, and we think of traditional music, but also, you know, music historically has been popular. You know, there weren't charts written, but you know, a song like Greensleeves, so you know, would have been very, very popular in Britain, you know, 500 years ago. It was a kind of a hit, if you like. Mm. So there always has been popular music. It's a mistake to think otherwise.
I think also you speak about this idea that perhaps those songs have been perfected over generations and by numerous singers purely because of the oral tradition. You might explain a little bit what you mean by that.
Well, I think in the last decade or the last 20 years, people have questioned the oral tradition as this pure thing. And it seems that sometimes at the origin of a song or sometimes halfway through the development of a song, there'll be a written version somewhere. You know, some local school teacher or vicar will, you know, take a traditional song and clean it up a bit, you know, like improve it. And then it will kind of sneak back into the tradition as a better song. There's a lot of examples of that. So, I mean, the oral tradition is a real thing. The music gets passed down in families. Is an extraordinary thing, and in the course of passing songs down, the bad verses do get leached away, and you're left with a stronger song at every generation. So that's a wonderful thing. But also credit should be given to people, the sort of minor poets or in some cases even hacks, who took these songs or even originated these songs and improved the language.
Of course, you did the opposite with Britney Spears, which was I didn't ever think I would be speaking to you and talking about Britney Spears at the same time. You took Whoops, I Did It Again. What you did with that was quite extraordinary. When did you suddenly notice that this had, if you like, that popular ballad style at its heart?
Well, it was pointed out to me. A friend said, oh, you know, you should really listen to this Britney Spears song. It's a really good song. And I said, you know, really? Are you serious? And I listened to it and I thought, well, you know, her version is very kind of bombastic and it's very, you know, very compressed and you know, the vocals are very kind of in your face. And I thought, well, if you strip all that away, what you're left with is actually a really good pop song. You know, it has, you know, a nice sort of ironic lyric. It has a really good tune structure. And the tune structure isn't actually that different, speaking historically, of a song from the time of Greensleeves. You know, it's the same kind of chord sequence that you're left with. So I just think it had the bones of a good song.
Let's listen to what you did with it and then what you do at the very end of the song, because I think that's where the part of the real genius lies.
Son.
So there you go. Who would have thought that you could get that type of instrumental, which, you know, pulls us right back, I suppose, to, I don't know what period precisely, but the 15th, 16th century, what you do with the guitar at the very end there.
Yeah, 15th, 1600s, absolutely. Well, it just seemed to all tie together, in my mind anyway.
When you're writing a song, how important is it, are the lyrics, as this is the oldest question for a songwriter in the world, of course, the lyrics versus the melody, but I think lyrics have always been important to you, and if you think of those ballads, of course, the storytelling element within them is vital to them. Is the lyric more often than not the starting point for you?
Sometimes it is the starting point. You know, there's basically two processes, you know, words to tune or tune to words, and sometimes the best songs are the ones that seem to appear all at the same time, but they're quite rare, I think, certainly for me anyway. I mean, back in Fairport, we were a lyric crazy band. You know, we used to do covers of Leonard Cohen, Joni Mitchell, Bob Dylan. So we were always concerned about lyrics, and I've really tried to keep that in my music as well. I like to think, you know, that a song has to have a good lyric, unless it's just a piece of dance music or something where it's much less important. And almost every kind of song carries some kind of story. It can be a very abbreviated story, or it can be more elaborate, more storytelling like a ballad. But I think every song says something in a narrative way.
When I spoke to lifelong fans of yours, one of the songs that kept coming up was 1952, Vincent Black Lightning. And this is a song from 1991. Another, you know, the question that keeps coming up again and again for a songwriter is that balance between autobiographical and totally imagined. Is there a very specific story behind 1952, Vincent Black Lightning?
Well, you know, I just made it up. It's absolutely fictional. A friend of mine had a Vincent Black shadow, slightly more mundane end of the Vincent spectrum. And I thought, well, that'd be a nice thing to build a song around. You know, is a Vincent Lightning? I mean, they only built 26, 27 Lightnings, so they're extremely valuable. The last one that went for auction last year was just under $1 million. It's kind of a mythological beast, if you like. You know, I just wrote a story, and I suppose, you know, the story comes from my interest in traditional music forms, in ballad forms, because it's like a ballad. It, you know, if you take away the contemporary references.
Says Red Molly to Jane, it's a fine motorbike, no girl can feel special in any such light. Says James to Red Molly, my hat's off to you. It's a Vincent Black Lightning 1952. But I've seen you at the corners and cafes, it seems. Red hair and black leather, my favorite color scheme. And he pulled her on behind and down to Box Hill they'd ride.
So while 1952, Vincent Black Lightning, then Richard Thompson, may have had a purely fictional story told behind it, I was also interested in something I heard you saying about a song from your 2015 album, Still. This is a song called Dungeons for Eyes. This was about something very specific that did happen, and it struck me, is there an Irish link here?
Well, you know, maybe. I mean, I kind of keep it vague. You know, it could be Irish, it could be something else, it could be African, in fact. But I mean, it's something that happened to me. I was at a charity event, and someone said, well, you must meet so-and-so. And I look across the room, and there's someone who I know is, if he hasn't actually murdered people, he's instructed people to be murdered. And I could not shake this person's hand. So I'll leave it as vague as that.
Yeah, and within this song, we'll hear a chorus that mentions about souls literally speaking to you. Was there a kind of some sense of hauntedness that put you forward into writing this song?
Well, I think, you know, the incident disturbed me enough. And it took me a long time to get around to writing the song. It took me at least 5 years of percolating it to actually get down to write it.
We'll finish up by listening to Dungeons for Eyes. But before we do that, the upcoming tour in the Kilkenny Arts Festival, primarily acoustic, primarily electric. Is that a big decision that has to be made nearly from the outset, Richard?
Well, but people can ask me to play in any format, you know, and if my band's available, I'm happy to come with the band. Acoustic's much easier, generally speaking. But, I mean, I love to do both. I love to be acoustic because it's a bit more intimate, and electric is a bit more, you know, a bit more swagger, a bit more rock and roll.
So it doesn't have to be apples or pears, it can be both.
It could be both, yes, absolutely, can be both.
Richard Thompson, thanks very much for speaking to us, and we'll finish up then by listening to Dungeons for Eyes. Dungeons for Eyes there from Richard Thompson, who plays the Kilkenny Arts Festival. He's at the Set Theatre, in fact, on Wednesday the 14th of August. And you can find out full details on kilkennyarts.ie and richardthompson-music.com.